Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 12th of March. 63,000 jobs were lost in this country in the month of February, and that was after a loss of 22,000 jobs in January. Manufacturing lost 52,000 in February, and that brought the losses over the past 12 months to 299,000 jobs. Most of the February decline concentrated in durable goods manufacturing, as motor vehicles and parts, furniture and related products, and wood products. And the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics reports that Wisconsin had the third largest percentage drop in jobs in the last 12 months. That was behind Rhode Island and Michigan. And that the Midwest has suffered greatly here, with the unemployment rate being 5.2%, which is the highest regional unemployment rate. We're going to be looking at this issue the first hour of our program today. And also, look, I don't know if you saw Bob Herbert's column yesterday, but he talks about the poor and the near poor in this country, and says that the U.S. has a population of 300 million people, 37 million, many of them children, are living in poverty. Close to 60 million are just one notch above the official poverty line. These are households that have incomes of $20,000 to $40,000 for a family of four. And he says that the economic pain and anxiety felt for so long by the poor and the near poor, and we can add that now to that list, people who have lost their jobs, has been spreading like a stain in the middle class, but neither the Democrats nor the Republicans have stepped up to this fundamental long-term challenge. And we're going to discuss all of this, the first hour of our program, with Professor Peter Morici. Professor Morici is a professor of international business at the University of Maryland, has also served as director of economics at the U.S. International Trade Commission. He's an expert on international economics and agreements, macroeconomics, industrial policy. He's advised many leading corporations and governments regarding trade and regulatory issues, and you see him frequently on CNN, ABC, Fox, National Public Radio, you hear him, the BBC. He's the author of 18 books, including Reconciling Trade and the Environment in the World Trade Organization, Labor Standards in the Global Trading System, Antitrust in the Global Trading System. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee today, the Milwaukee line is 414-227-2055. 414-227-2050. Professor Peter Morici, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome. It's nice to be with you.
Let's start with those numbers here. Is that a huge loss of jobs?
Yes, it is. And the real problem is that it's just the beginning. Mm. The economy really is in a swoon owing to the large trade deficit and the breakdown of the banks in New York. We can talk about the reasons behind the trade deficit. It's principally oil and trade with China. And trade with China really relates very much to your opening comments in the hour. Those job losses are very permanent. We've probably lost 2 million manufacturing jobs, a good number of them in your part of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not coming back. And when people lose those jobs, they fall out of the middle class.
Hmm. So they fall into that class, which is very large. When I cited the statistics of the poor and the near poor, there are a lot of Americans in that category.
Well, I mean, there are 2,000 hours in a year. If you're making $15 an hour, that gives you, you know, $30,000 income. Where does that leave you if you got two kids to support,
right,
two small children,
mm-hmm,
your spouse has to work part-time? It's pretty tough. I think that sometimes the poverty statistics, you know, exaggerate the notion of who is poor. I don't know that someone in a family of four with a $35,000 income is necessarily poor. It depends on where they live, the access to social services, and so forth. But it's certainly a very stressful situation. And what's more is a lot of the stress is being manufactured by lousy trade policies, which, by the way, don't expect Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama to fix.
Well, they seem to be in a bit of trouble about that lately, don't they, both of them?
Well, they like to bash NAFTA when the real problem is China. Mexico's not the problem. And the aspects of NAFTA they want to fix work in the U.S. favor. I mean, the investment clause basically guarantees fair treatment, safety, and security for U.S. property in Mexico, much like our bilateral investment treaties with other countries around the world. I don't think we want to get rid of that. They're demagoguing the issue, to be quite frank. It's very disappointing. It's very disappointing indeed.
And what do you mean when you say the real problem is the trade with China? How so?
Well, China subsidizes its exports into the United States. I mean, certainly we should be importing some things from China and selling stuff there, but they have subsidized their exports into the United States, and they greatly restrict our exports into China. So we have this mammoth trade deficit with China, about $260 billion a year, and it costs us a lot of jobs. It's that plain simple. For example, in the auto parts sector, a lot of the supply chain is moving to China simply because they won't let Americans make cars in China unless they import the parts, and they really make it very difficult for us to export cars, to China. And the United States really is a good place to do those things. I mean, that's why the Japanese move factories here. So, that's really where the problem is. Mrs. Clinton likes to run on the fact that she was part of the last Clinton administration. Well, they made this deal with China. She's accountable for it, and she doesn't want to fix it. Both Obama and Clinton have had the opportunity to endorse bills, support bills in the Congress that would take substantive action towards China, and they have declined to do so.
What about McCain?
McCain basically would continue the same policy. My view is vote for McCain because if you're voting on trade, because at least he's being honest about it.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean, I'm necessarily saying vote for McCain, across the board. But, I mean, McCain's being straightforward. Clinton and Obama like to go to places like Ohio and drum up a lot of anxiety and expectations, but they're not going to deliver.
Mm-hmm. So this whole policy with China needs to be fixed. How would you fix it?
Well, we need to get China out of the business of subsidizing its exports by manipulating its currency. Last year, it spent $460 billion intervening in foreign exchange markets to keep the value of its currency low. That came to a 44% subsidy on its exports. That's huge. I'd basically tax American conversion of dollars into yuan at the same rate and lower that tax as the Chinese lowered their intervention. So if they stopped intervening, it would go away. I don't view that as protectionism. I view that as offsetting a foreign subsidy. But Secretary Paulson runs around the country saying any kind of proposal like that is protectionist, and all he's really doing is obfuscating the issue. It's costing us dearly in terms of jobs, and we're running up a mammoth debt. It's also part of the reason we have the credit problem we have, because the Chinese convert those dollars into bonds, which created all that cheap money that the banks, spread around. We've lost control of our monetary policy because of it.
So why stay with it? I mean, who's benefiting from it?
Well, American companies that invest in China don't want anything to upset the apple cart. So you see paradoxical positions. For example, Ford and General Motors love to rail against the undervalued Japanese currency. They do that by keeping their interest rates low. But they don't say a word about the Chinese currency because they're producing there, and they're concerned if the United States takes action, it'll upset, relations with China, and the Chinese will get nasty to American companies there. Ditto Wall Street. They're all establishing branches in China.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they have to establish in China to do business there. The intellectual property people in California, Hollywood, the folks in the software industry, they need the good graces of the Chinese government to protect their intellectual property. So anything to upset things. So we have American companies profiting greatly in China, which lobby vociferously against any kind of action. My poster boy for this is Caterpillar. I mean, Caterpillar is just absolutely cynical on this issue.
Caterpillar, how so?
Well, they're well established in China. They produce there and make a lot of money, and they lobby very hard against any kind of actions that would redress this problem.
Hmm.
So American firms are sort of divided. Those that are competing with imports from China or that would like to export there but are not established there. And then the multinationals who see more gain from just moving over there. The Chinese want to play this game, we'll move over there, we'll move our supply chain there. I mean, General Motors, is very happy to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, as a result, who's making all the money? Corporations are making a lot more money. Who's getting the money?
Well, the folks that are established in China are making money there. People like Caterpillar and General Motors, Ford, General Electric, IBM, Citigroup, they are making money there.
That figure is astounding that we've lost 2 million jobs, isn't it? 2 million.
Yeah, I'd say about 1 million of them are due to China directly, and then a lot of Asian countries have to follow China's currency policy, so we probably lose another 1 million that way.
Hmm.
We've lost 3.6 million manufacturing jobs on Bush's watch. We expect to lose some to technology, But trust me, productivity hasn't gone up that much in manufacturing. They like to point to productivity to obfuscate the issue. But the numbers don't add up. But a lot of stuff in the Bush administration doesn't add up.
So when John McCain said in Michigan, these jobs are gone and they're not coming back, and everybody criticized him for that, and nobody wanted to hear that in Michigan, nobody wants to hear that in the country, what could come back? What's going to create jobs so that people can live?
If you get the exchange rate right, a lot of stuff that is now economical to make in China won't be economical to make in China. It's that simple. And so production would reestablish here. If it can leave, it can come back. Factories, machines, they're mobile. You can pick them up and put them on ships and move them around. A lot of it would be on the durable goods side, stuff that's fabricated from metal. That's where a lot of the really strong productivity growth has been in U.S. manufacturing and a lot of the innovation and so forth. You know, it's not stuff that you and I see. You know, you go to the Walmart to see a coffee maker. Coffee makers are going to come from China. It makes no sense to make those things here. Mm-hmm. But compressors, air conditioners, refrigerators, things like that, industrial equipment, that kind of stuff is moving. And that's very innovative stuff. And it should really stay here. One of the things people don't realize is just how high-tech an automobile is. An automobile has more software in it by dollar value than steel.
So, Professor, how would you get the exchange rate right? Who does that? Is that a legislative thing that happens?
Well, basically, if the Chinese stop intervening in currency markets and we let markets determine what the currency should be, then that's how you get it right. You know, people talk about, is a strong dollar good, is a weak dollar good? The value of the dollar that makes sense is the one that clears the market. And right now, we don't have that. So the dollar can't adjust adequately against the Asian currencies, and then it over-adjusts to compensate against the European currencies. So the dollar is undervalued in Asia, and overvalued in Asia, and undervalued against the euro. If you look objectively at what a euro can buy, it should not be 150 to a dollar. That's just overvaluing the euro. But the dollar is compensating. The markets are sort of compensating. The water goes to the point of least resistance.
You have been quoted as saying that the economic expansion has ended, the economy has slipped into a recession of uncertain depth and duration. Is that pretty much fact now that we're in a recession?
Well, it's never fact until the numbers are in. You know, I mean, it's never fact until you see two negative quarters of growth. But it is my view that the recession began the Monday after Labor Day. Black Friday was a great day. All the women went out as is custom and spent a lot of money. And then that Monday, retail sales died. They were tapped out, and things died. And they haven't really recovered since then. We had job losses in December and January, 2 months in a row. Retail sales aren't even keeping up with inflation. It's a pretty dire situation. And the stimulus package, while it will be helpful, is really coming too little too late. A lot of the measures taken by the Federal Reserve are behind the curve. The banking system in New York is fundamentally broken. We have a systemic breakdown in New York with the big banks, and that's not getting repaired. So I don't see this downturn ending soon. I mean, I'm not perfect. I'm an economist, and we all know about economists. But, you know, it was either this or become a tarot card reader, I guess. So and I decided at least this was more scientific.
Is it more fun, though?
Yeah. I used to tease my mother that I really should have been a matrimonial lawyer, and then everybody would hate me. And she says, you know, Peter, the way you do economics, you're pretty close already.
The other news that came out yesterday, and I don't understand this at all, with this loss of jobs, the Labor Department also said there was a slight decrease in the unemployment rate to 4.8%. How could that be?
A lot of people quit the labor force. The way they compute unemployment is to add two numbers together. They add up the number of people that are employed and the number of people that are seeking jobs. And that's the denominator. And the numerator are the people that are seeking jobs, those that are unemployed that would like to have a job. If people leave the labor force, if they quit looking, they get taken out of the computation. And we had hundreds of thousands of people leave the labor force last month.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We have a whole bank of phones already busy. Our guest is Professor Peter Morrissey. He's a professor of international business at the University of Maryland. We're talking about the job report that was released yesterday showing that Wisconsin had the third largest percentage drop in jobs. It showed that there was a loss of jobs of 63,000 after a loss of 22,000 in January. He's talking about trade with China and China being a big problem here, that we need to get the exchange rate right. And actually, when you look at it, we've lost 2 to 3 million jobs. 2 to 3 million jobs because of these policies. 800-486-8655 is the number, and let us start our calls with Bill from Deerfield. Hi, Bill.
Hey, it's great to talk with College Park, Maryland. It seems to me like we're in kind of a catch-22 or a real bind with China, and that is that if we try to force them to float their currency on the world market, or if we try to get them to stop subsidizing their exports, they own such a huge amount of our debt, it seems like they have this cudgel over our head that they could not roll over the debt, or and that would send interest rates up. What do you think?
They don't have to roll over the debt. They hold the bonds. The real question is, would they dump the dollars? If they dump the dollars, that would so force up the value of the yuan that it wouldn't make any sense to make anything in China. Now, that would create a bit of a problem here. In fact, it would create probably a crisis. And people would be very upset. But the Chinese Communist Party has an autocratic rule situation in China, and basically the deal is they have to deliver prosperity and reasonable order to stay in power. If the unemployment that would follow the dumping of the dollars worked out, there'd be so many people looking for a job in Shanghai that I don't think that the Communist Party would survive in power. My feeling is the level of social unrest that would precipitate would be off the wall. Now, the trick to doing this is to manage up the yuan and manage down the dollar. You don't just pull the slats out overnight. If China would revalue by 15% tomorrow and raise the value of its currency, say, 3% a month after that, over a period of about 3 years, this situation would be resolved. And by the way, we have had those kinds of currency shifts. With regard to other currencies, it's manageable. This is not an unmanageable situation. So that this can be done in a reasonable and orderly way. But the Chinese government has correctly recognized that, A, an undervalued currency creates a lot of jobs in China, and, B, the Bush administration isn't about to do anything about it. So they're very happy to talk to us and have lunch in expensive restaurants in Beijing and Washington. But that's what's going on. I mean, nothing is going to happen, and the Democratic Congress hasn't been any better. Chuck Schumer introduced a bill that would put a 22.5% tariff, I believe it was, on Chinese goods, but he said openly it was a bluff. Well, that's as if these guys don't have an embassy down the street here and don't know it's a bluff. I mean, how well do they listen when I testify at the International Trade Commission? They're sitting two tables behind me taking notes, and who am I? You think they don't listen to what Schumer says? So, I visited his office, and they tell me it's a bluff. So, I mean, the Chinese know that. They know the Americans really are full of hot air on this issue, so they're not going to act. It's that simple.
Are you still there, Bill? Anything more? Bill's gone. Thanks for the call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Peter Morrissey is our guest, professor of international business at the University of Maryland. We're talking about why there was such a huge job loss in this country last month and the month before, and actually for the last year and even further back than that. 800-486-8655. We also have an email address. If you'd like to send us an email, it's talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, we just thought it's time to have some fun. We'll talk with one of the authors of Bad Baby Names. How about these? And they're real. Garage Empty, Hysteria Johnson, King Arthur, Infinity Hubbard, Please Cope, Major Slaughter, several Satans, and all kinds of I'm a hog, I'm a pig, I'm a muskrat, I'm a nut, and I'm a hooker. That's the second hour of our program today. Peter Morrissey is with us now. He is professor of international business at the University of Maryland, has served as director of economics at the International Trade Commission, is an expert on international economics and agreements, macroeconomics, and industrial policy. And we go next to Jake from Menasha. Hi, Jake.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to tell the professor that he is absolutely correct, and I wish he would get himself on Lou Dobbs, CNN, because Lou Dobbs has been talking about this for years and years and years. And Ralph Nader, politically, has been talking about this for years and years and years. And he needs to get himself in front of those two people who have a big forum and talk about this. I wanted to ask the guest whether what I think we have in America is government-guaranteed capitalism. And I think what China has is state monopoly capitalism. And could you comment, please?
Well, I don't think we have government-guaranteed capitalism, although right now what Bernanke is doing for the banks is getting darn close. He's taking so much bad paper off their books without requiring them to straighten out their business practices. That's why I think it's a palliative what he's done. I don't know that we have monopoly capitalism in China anymore. Basically, the deal in China is they want you to make the stuff there, and they are holding back some industries for Chinese companies. It's very difficult to be a major steel company in China if you're not Chinese. Not so much if you're in the automobile industry. In other industries, it gets very interesting. China, they're so creative about this. China has capped regional airlines in China. You know, they just don't want any more of them. They want the regional airlines they have to build out. However, they will allow a newer regional airline if it agrees to buy all of its planes from a new Chinese manufacturer. Now, that's a non-tariff barrier if I ever saw one. The only one that was better than that was in Korea, mystically, as they were developing their car industry. Nobody wanted to buy imported cars. You could bring them in, but nobody wanted to buy them. It turns out that if you bought an imported car, you got your income taxes audited.
Hmm.
Now, you know, you got to admire people that are that creative. But what you can't admire is the fact that those kinds of things go unanswered by our government. I'm for free trade. I have a book entitled Making Free Trade Work. I'm a big advocate of free trade. But if we're going to have free trade in goods, we have to have free trade in currency. And if we're going to have free trade, it's going to be, two-way.
Yeah.
But, I mean, here, we generally let companies fail. What the problem is the banks are like the water company. You know, if the water company breaks in Madison, Wisconsin, the university has to shut down and everybody goes home. Well, in capitalism, if the banks break down, if they go out of business, the system shuts down because so many companies need loans to just stay in business, operating capital. Farmers in your part of the world surely need it, so we really can't let the banks break. Unfortunately, he's pumping them up with money without requiring anything from them.
Thank you very much for the call, Jake. I want to go back. Let's go to the Midwest again for a moment here. All of those manufacturing jobs, I'm speaking to you from Milwaukee, where we had so many manufacturing jobs. We had, you know, people who had family-supporting jobs here for a long period of time, and they're gone. And I'm wondering, you know, what needs to happen in the Midwest, which has been particularly hard hit, and in other parts of the country, to either change the economy, to do different kinds of jobs, to bring... Well, we talked some about bringing those jobs back from China, but to allow people to live good lives again.
Well, I mean, the service sector isn't all negative. I mean, we really talk about service jobs, and you say, think of flipping hamburgers and so forth, and there is that. It's really a generational thing. If you're 45 or 50 years old and you lose your job, it's hard to become a computer programmer. But if you're a younger person, and going to school, the important thing is to learn a skill that will be of value in the service economy. Unfortunately, our higher education institutions too much emphasize liberal arts kinds of activities that don't also impart a skill. 25, 30 years ago, it was possible to major in English and go to Wall Street and get involved in finance, or go to work to IBM in sales and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Today, that is not possible because those things have become more technical. And our university system and the expectations we have of children have not kept up with that. And that's why, for example, we don't have enough engineers and so forth. If you go back to the turn of the 20th century, it was very common at state universities for the men that went, you know, in those days women didn't go, to major in engineering. And at the service academies as well. Engineering was what Americans studied if they went to state institutions. That is not the case anymore. And we need to return to that kind of thinking. Now, I know I'm going to get thousands of phone calls from French professors now But the bottom line is that even if you, when I was a kid, if you majored in economics, you got a job on Wall Street. Not so today. You have to major in finance. It's just a hard reality that the global economy requires more specialized skills.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to be a journalist, you study journalism. You don't major in English. It's going to be tougher to get a job if you do.
So where are the jobs that where we don't have enough people for them?
Well, we certainly don't have enough people in the medical professions. We don't have enough people in finance. We absolutely don't have enough people in the technology sector. One of the reasons so many technology jobs are fleeing to India is because we're not training the folks here, or the folks aren't taking advantage of the training. And if you look at the engineering schools, they're full of foreign students who now are going home as opposed to staying because there are great opportunities in Asia. I don't at all criticize the engineering schools for doing that. But the real reason they have so many foreign students is they can't fill their seats with Americans. We don't emphasize mathematics enough in high school and have an expectation that it is not okay not to be able to do it well in math, that we need to do that. And we need to be focusing on undergraduate education as having a vocational content as well as a broadening in educational content.
Steve from Madison, hi.
Hi, thank you. Could you guys please comment on the Chinese tendency to pirate the technology and copy it? I have the impression that they're maybe the worst in the world at doing that. And in terms of how might we bring pressure against them to, play better with the rest of the world, is pressuring them, like, through boycotting of Olympics? Or how do we do it?
Well, first of all, pirating technology is an endemic problem in the developing world. And it's not exactly as though we're free of it here. Think of how much pirated software is on the computers of Americans. You know, borrowed software without a license, and so forth. But it's an endemic problem in developing countries. In China, a particular problem is you don't have a well-developed court system. And although the Chinese government signs agreements, it's very dependent on provincial courts to enforce those U.S. property rights in China, or the property rights of any advanced industrialized country that has, you know, technology that it's selling there. It's as if we didn't have federal courts in the United States. We only had state courts to enforce federal statutes. Now, one of the problems you run into is that the provincial governments are very much engaged in economic development in China, and local companies are considered champions, and it is very hard to beat a local company in its own courthouse. We even have a little bit of trouble with that here. Several years ago, there was an insurance case down in Louisiana where a Canadian company just didn't get a reasonable deal, and the U.S. government had to pay, you know, compensation. But part of it is the underdeveloped court system in China. There's really limits to what you can accomplish. And this is one of the reasons that companies like Microsoft often don't want some help from the U.S. government. They want some support, but they also want to be able to negotiate on their own. Because often what you've got to do is basically negotiate your way through it. And that often means establishing R&D labs there, which transfer technology and the ability to create technology. Now, we certainly can't block the transfer of technology that way. However, this encourages things in China that would be more economically done here, and that deprives Americans of good jobs.
Maybe this is making too much of a technology. We did a show a couple days ago on 35,000 jobs could be created in the state of Wisconsin if we move more toward green technology. China, you can't breathe in China. Athletes are saying we can't go to the Olympics. How about if we really moved, and this is something that the presidential candidates have been talking about, in a huge way, moved in that kind of technology, became world leaders, went to China, say, hey, we got this. You don't have this kind of technology. We're going to clean up your air, and we're going to have something that is cutting edge in the world.
I think that's what we call a very supply-side response. You know, this is what I want, and so this is what I can do, so I think you'll buy it, and I don't think it'll work. The Chinese will get green when they are well off enough to afford it. The notion, for example, that we should adopt cap and trade because if we don't adopt it, they won't adopt it. That may be true, but if we adopt it, they won't necessarily adopt it. We've got to be careful as we move into a more progressive environmental era era that we don't merely just export the jobs, that we don't impose conditions on American companies which just cause them to move to China to make the product because it's too costly to make it here. For example, the global warming legislation moving through Congress would be very, very difficult for a lot of American manufacturers to bear because it would just make the use of energy too expensive. If we could get the Chinese to go along, it would be great. But at the end of the day, you know, we can't force a foreign country to be responsible internationally. And a good working assumption is that right now and into the foreseeable future, China will be irresponsible on trade, investment, the environment, and a variety of issues. Mm-hmm. And China is a very selfish child. Mm-hmm. We've spoiled her, and she behaves so.
Is it really too costly to make things here, or are people just too greedy here?
Oh, no. People aren't greedy. When you negotiate your salary, don't you try to do as well as you can?
Usually not.
But
I'm strange.
You know, I don't believe that. I don't believe that. There is greedy behavior in the corporate sector, but there's greedy behavior in all sectors of the economy. There's greedy behavior among torts lawyers. You don't hear Democrats complaining about that. My feeling is that is not the fundamental issue. People are going to make things where it makes sense economically to make them because they have to. You know, in a lot of products, the profit margins are pretty thin. I mean, Toyota only makes about $1,000 a car. When you look at what those cars cost, that's not much. And so when you're dealing on thin margins, you really can't afford to be at a disadvantage where you make things because you have a government regulation the other guy doesn't have. If the Chinese would get responsible on global warming, they have a GDP that's one-fourth of ours, but they emit more stuff into the air than we do already. If they would be willing to get responsible, we could help them get it done. We could sell them the stuff they need. They have the money to buy it with their huge trade surplus. But they just don't seem to be inclined. I mean, they'll find advantage any way they can get it. You go to Shanghai, the children in the wintertime are going to school without heat, and they're wearing coats in the classrooms.
Mm. Thanks to you for the call. Frank from Madison, hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Very interesting guests. May I ask a question and pose a proposition? And I think they're both naive, so perhaps
I wouldn't call you naive, Frank. So it's probably quite sophisticated.
is it the case that effectively we chose to go to a sort of FIRE economy, finance, insurance, and real estate, and we enabled that over the last two decades, and a productive economy was let go hang? And we found out that the FIRE economy has major downsides, and we're seeing that in the banking system and on Wall Street now. And that to remedy this, we have to go to being, I said I'm naive, to a productive economy, and that effectively means that the dollar has to be worth much less and that we have to behave as a poorer, production-oriented society. So, thank you.
Well, that's
Thanks,
a mouthful. I don't like the idea of productive versus unproductive. Bankers are productive. You can't run a market economy without bankers. Bankers are productive people, and I don't think you'd want to live without life insurance or car insurance. That's a productive activity. However, by virtue of the trade policy we have pursued, we have caused our goods-producing sectors, in particular manufacturing, to be run down. And so the economy is out of balance. We don't produce enough of the kinds of things that we should. And that lowers efficiency. It lowers GDP. It lowers R&D. And it makes us all poorer for it on average. Now, some people have gotten very, very wealthy through peculiar behavior on Wall Street that needs to be redressed, but that is not the general rule. So it's more a process of balance. If we could get the currency situation straight with China and open up the markets in Asia to American products, I think you'd find that we could trade, we could have balanced trade and do a lot better, or we could have more balanced trade or less unbalanced trade. Another real problem we have is in the energy sector, because we have within our grasp many interesting things that we can do that aren't terribly costly to reduce our oil consumption.
For example, automobile emissions and automobile oil use are just way out of line for what could be accomplished at not a terribly large cost, and would not place our industries at a disadvantage, and that would go a long way to reduce the trade deficit. The oil deficit is now 60% of the trade deficit, and the China deficit is 30%. If you can't fix the trade deficit without fixing oil in China, it's that simple.
Mm. Thanks for the call. Sandy is next from Algoma. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. First of all, I'm a nurse. And so I'm kind of looking at things from the medical viewpoint. I see that probably 85% of our patients are Medicare patients. They're all over the age of 65, right? So to me, it seems like the Medicare system is propping up the healthcare system, the entire healthcare system. And since Medicare is all federal government, that's all borrowed money. Right now, we're all running on borrowed money from China, from India, or wherever it comes from. And our manufacturing base is gone that was holding up our country before. So if you can tell me what you think is going to happen when we start having to be accountable for all this money that we've borrowed.
Well, we're going to have to pay it back, or we're going to have to pay interest on it, and that's going to be painful. It comes out to about $2,000 for every American worker per year at the point where we are now. So that's going to be painful once we can no longer borrow just to pay the interest. But it's not an insurmountable problem if we deal with it now. As for Medicaid, in the healthcare sector, in the United States, we pay about 50% more for medicine in terms of whether it's doctor's visits or drugs or what have you than the Europeans do. The Europeans regulate prices and they ration. Hillary can talk all she wants about providing health care for all Americans, but if she's not willing to do that, it's just not affordable. That is going to be a very difficult thing for Americans to swallow, both price regulations and rationing. But we're already spending 16 or 17% of GDP on health care last time I looked. And if you want to cover the 45 million that are uninsured, and if you look at what Hillary Care looked like the last time, I mean, where she would throw everything into health care, you know, anything that anybody wanted to do would be covered, it would be like 25% of GDP, and that's just impossible. She's making promises she can't keep. It's that simple. We have to address and work through in our minds the notion of the healthcare sector being a very different space than the rest of the market economy, and with very strong entrenched interests that are not going to permit us to do the things we need to do easily. I mean, we don't need to re-import drugs. We need to force the drug companies to charge us what they charge in France or Germany, period. I mean, why should the American people be paying, you know, twice what the Europeans
right,
pay
you're
for
right.
drugs to
mm.
pay? So the R&D takes place here and they get the cures. In the end of the day, if we force them to charge us what they charge in Europe, then they'd have to charge the Europeans more and us less. It's that simple. But that's going to be a hard thing for us to accept, and we're going to have a dialogue about that and work our way through it before we can get the Congress to implement it.
Well, I think the American people would agree with what you just said, that the case is closed.
Oh, I don't know about that. I think
really?
Maybe the folks in Wisconsin that you talk to would agree about that. But Virginia's a more conservative place where I'm speaking to you from right now. And I have a lot of friends that if you talk to them about the government running anything, they rightfully think about buying stamps. If you want to know why people are ambivalent about national health care, go try to buy stamps in Madison, Wisconsin at noon. You stand on a nice long line, and then would you like the person that finally greets you to be the one deciding which doctor you see? I don't think so. The government doesn't provide services very flexibly. And anyone who's had a nightmare with the state taxing authority, you know, you say an income tax issue at the state level where you can't get your phone calls returned, where you talk to a different person each time when you finally do get them on the phone, where they can't seem to close the case. I mean, I don't know that I want to be dealing with a cancer issue with those characters.
Yeah, but when you talk about drug companies and selling their products, you know, overseas for what they ought to cost and what they're selling them for here, that's what I was referring to, that the American people would say that's really wrong.
That's probably something that we could deal with pretty quickly.
But we don't.
Well, I mean, we have a very democratic campaign contribution system in the United States. You have to raise lots and lots of money of $5,000 a whack from lots and lots of people.
And the drug business is one place where you can do that. Mm-hmm. Another place is the banks.
Yep.
You know, we've been keeping score like it's the Super Bowl between the Obama and Clinton campaigns with how much money they're raising. Well, you know, those are all special interests they're going to expect. It's no wonder the Democrats in Congress are not holding hearings about the real issues on Wall Street right now. They're raising too much money up there. It's not just the Republicans that have a problem. It's both parties because of the kind of campaign money they're raising from these interests.
Thanks, Sandy, so much for your call. We need to pause for a moment and we'll return. Our guest is Professor Peter Morrissey. He's a professor of international business at the University of Maryland. We're talking about the economy, which he says has slipped into a recession of uncertain depth and duration, and looking at the news yesterday that showed that this country had lost 63,000 jobs in the month of February, 22,000 in January. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Did I give you a number? You know, you forget. You do it 50 million times. 800-486-8655. Milwaukee callers 414-227-2050. And that's that. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, one of the authors of Bad Baby Names. We're going to have some fun. It's time for fun. So fun the second hour as we look at bad baby names. All right, let's go back to phone calls now for Professor Peter Morrissey, professor of international business at the University of Maryland. He's also served as director of economics at the U.S. International Trade Commission, an expert on international economics and agreements, macroeconomics, and industrial policy. Todd from Appleton, hello.
Hi, good morning, Kathleen, and good morning to your guest. And I want to thank your guest for speaking so frankly about these issues. What we need is a breath of, reality speak. And there's too many people that are shying away from these issues. Mm. Your comments about the educational system were certainly on target. Your comments about the what's going on in Congress and the political contributions is also certainly on target, as are many other topics. In fact, you mentioned global warming and the issue there. And one of the key quotes I think I heard about this was from Jacques Chirac, former French president, who said the Kyoto Treaty was the, quote, first step toward true global governance, unquote. We know that there's ulterior motives to this, and it's certainly not going to help us to try to adhere to all the policies. It's going to hurt our economy, particularly when I think of the top 20 most polluted cities in the world, 12 were in China, none were in the United States. The rest of the world's got a lot of catching up to do to get to our level of cleanliness. But I just wanted to say I appreciate your efforts, but also to ask you if there is any particular organization that you are aware of where you can really honestly be a participant in and actually get the attention of your congressman or your senator, because I write them all the time. I email them. I do all kinds of different, ways of getting together with them, call their offices. I get a polite, we'll take your thoughts into consideration. Thank you. Goodbye. And that's all the time they have for me because, I'm not coming in there with a thick checkbook or a wallet.
There are several nonprofits that focus on competitiveness issues and that are for a more affirmative trade policy. For example, there's the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. There are some regional groups. There is the U.S. Business and Industry Council, there are some others. Unfortunately, I don't have them like a list in front of me to give you. But, if you surf the web, try, competitiveness, American jobs, things, Google that, you're going to start to come up with some organizations that you could become involved with. One of the basic problems you have to remember is that congressmen get visited by a lot of different people with a lot of different interests. And each one by himself or herself has really limited influence on what legislation goes through Congress. But I will say this, that Nancy Pelosi and Rangel over at the Trade Committee, were supposed to do something about this trade issue. And they seem to know how to get legislation through when they want to. For example, they got the minimum wage legislation through very quickly. But there's a good China trade bill working its way through the House, and we just can't get a vote on it. and the leadership won't let it happen. And, you know, they seem to know how to get done what's important to them or what they can make political gain out of. But what is an issue that cuts in two directions and is more difficult, they don't. The ethanol issue to me is that I know in your part of the world this is going to seem like heresy, but I don't believe that feeding our cars corn is a very good solution to the global warming or the energy dependence issue. We can't really grow that much corn to do it. The only real solution is to make the cars use less energy, to make them use more electricity, to plug them in more, and to, frankly, generate nuclear power. Because if you're going to use electricity in cars, it doesn't do any good to generate the electricity with coal. And those are all, you know, tough issues to address, and they upset people. It's very easy to make Iowa farmers happy by passing an ethanol law. But this is one of the areas where, you know, I sort of agree with McCain. He's a little bit more frank with people about those kinds of things.
Thanks very much for the call. We go to Dick next from one of our favorite cities in the whole country, Dubuque, Iowa. Hello, Dick.
Boy, did I set myself up.
Well, a couple of things. You know, just I've been listening quite a while. But, like, you know, and the changes in the last 50 years, like my dad worked at Dubuque Pack, raised six kids, was part of the middle class. I was a quality and safety manager at Ertl Toys, and we still had 1,000 people working there up into the 90s. The simple-minded way of breaking jobs down is people work with things, or they work with information, or they work with people. Now, the working with things part of it, we're again dealing with issues that are hard to control in China, EPA and OSHA issues that our country, you know, we want to have. So we end up working with jobs more in the working with information and working with people, and working with things has been downplayed. We're to the detriment of the middle class, the working class, so to speak, and the whole economy, in my way of thinking. I don't know how you can translate that into an economic equation, but what's your thoughts on that?
Balance. Economies need to be balanced. They need to do what they do best and trade and compete in the world. What I have been saying or trying to say is that we have been unfairly tipping the scales against the industries that make things in the United States, that there are many things that we could be making here that we don't, and we could make them cost competitively because we have a broken trade policy and we have let other countries exploit our markets without giving us fair access to theirs. It is also a fact that people that work in factories like to send their kids to college, so they won't have to work in factories anymore. They want them to move up, and people in the ideas business often, you know, have more pleasant working conditions. So we do aspire as a society, you know, to sort of work into the idea areas, and we're going to have some migration in that direction. The question is how much, and what I'm saying is that we have over-adjusted by virtue of a bad trade policy, which has been propagated by both Democratic and Republican administrations. This is a bipartisan debacle, and it needs to be fixed. But I don't hear anything from the three leading presidential candidates right now that gives me a lot of hope.
Mm. How's Dubuque, Dick? We miss it. It's good.
We're like the state of Dubuque here. We're holding our own with all the snowbound. Yeah, hopefully it melts slow.
Right.
The river doesn't rise that much.
Right, yeah. Well, it's on its way to melt in a little bit. Thanks for the call. Steve from Houston, Texas. Hi.
Yeah, good morning. Hey, Professor Morrissey, appreciate so much your thoughts and somebody speaking tough on China. I'm reading this morning in the Wall Street Journal that several countries in the Middle East, United Arab Emirates, is strongly considering not pegging their currency to the dollar. And I've heard it said that the only thing that's holding oil, you know, from exploding into, you know, where we get $4, $4.50 a gallon of gas is the fact that the Middle East and countries peg oil to the dollar. And I've heard that Saudi Arabia is also considering this because of their inflationary rates. And I'm just wondering, you know, that with the, you know, the spiraling down of the American economy, and I personally think we haven't even seen the tip of the iceberg yet. That's my personal assessment, looking at everything. What's the potential for, you know, for the world to basically abandon the dollar? And I look at China, And there's going to come a point where they're not going to need America anymore. And if they dump our currency, you know, our economy's finished, isn't it? I mean, I don't.
I need to hold you there, Steve. We have about 30 seconds.
I think that unpegging the currencies in the Middle East to the dollar would actually benefit us. I wouldn't lose much sleep about the Chinese torpedoing the U.S. economy by dumping all the dollars.
Well, that was succinct. Great.
Well, you said I had 30 seconds.
You only took 10. That's good,
though. I'm good at that, too.
Thanks very much for being with us. It was
Oh, it's been a real pleasure. I hope to visit with you again.
Yes, please return. Our guest, Professor Peter Morrissey, professor of international business at the University of Maryland. He also was director of economics at the U.S. International Trade Commission. He has advised many leading corporations and governments regarding trade and regulatory issues and is a frequent guest on major networks, CNN, CNBC, ABC, Fox. He's been on National Public Radio, author of 18 books, including Reconciling Trade and the Environment in the World Trade Organization. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this interesting hour, and thanks for all of your calls, sophisticated calls on the economy. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll return, and we're just going to have some fun. It's time for some fun. Winter's not over. And we're going to, I think, probably laugh a little bit. If you have a name that you think is a horrible name that you were given, or maybe you've changed your name because it was so bad, or you know somebody who has a strange name, bad baby names, following the news.